baby bought me a bagel this morning.
Bought you a bagel.
Got me a bagel with salmon and cream cheese.
Delicious. Did you like bagels before you went to New York City?
I don't think I'd ever had a bagel before I went to New York City. Father! I don't think I had one. I think they're quite delicious, but they're quite heavy sometimes. Hopefully, I mean, it's still kind of early-ish, well, it's noon, but I get very tired after I have a bagel, you know? But the salmon and cream cheese, hopefully, is the protein I need to have a better start to the day. Shock horror. I was watching Law and Order SVU, gunk, gunk. I paused it to record the podcast. And one of the things I really like about Law and Orders, plural, is that they use real life stories and implement them in their storylines, but loosely based kind of thing. So the one that's happening now is very Jeffrey I'm having a stroke.
Epstein.
Yeah, Epstein. And so basically a very, very rich guy has a girlfriend who tries to like court young girls onto his, and then they just had an there's just a line where he's like, looks like you won't be getting any more massages on your island. Gank, gank. But it's kind of fun how they kind of, you know, like show everything happening and blah, blah, blah. And she's so I just paused it, but I have a feeling the girlfriend is going to turn on him. If she doesn't kill herself first. So this would be good.
This is, should we just watch it real quick, the only podcast in the world that will give updates on Kelly's Law and Order watching updates. I am Dr. Damien Gibson. I didn't go to 114 years of law and order school to be called...
Good job.
Constable. Thank you very much. And in the blue corner, it is the Italian Geldon.
Was a terrible bird.
It's the Italian Geldon. It is the woman that will fucking rip your fucking arms off if you get in the way of her and her pokies. It is Kelly Big Whoop. Wanna fight about her for Stuka.
Yeah, that's me.
She is.
Yeah, that's me. I think the electric blanket that I have... I think it's working as well as it used to. I might have to get another electric blanket because I'm very cold.
It's definitely a clipboard.
Late show reference number one.
Coming in early.
Did you see the thing I sent you on TikTok? Someone, I think it was actually Working Dog. They've got like clips of Barge Ass and stuff.
Yeah.
And it's one of my favorite scenes of Barge Ass. If you don't know Barge Ass, YouTube it. It's pretty great. Where he's like, no, son, you won't be needing a pad and pen for this one. You do the voice very well, yes.
Hi, I'm Damien Gibson. I'll be reading for the part of Barjas today. Put your notepad away, son, you won't be needing that. My order's simple. A shitload of dim sims and a bucket of soya sauce.
Hang on, Sarge. She can't light up. It's basically a show about fart jokes and it's fantastic.
Yeah, The Late Show, which we reference all the time, was a sketch show that ran for 2 years, right?
2 years, 92, 93.
92, 93, and we were babies growing up watching it and it both got us into comedy, basically. Kelly obviously got into comedy properly and I have just been watching from
just
afar like a creep.
Teetering on the outside. I'm a creep. Yeah, just being looking at comedy.
Just trying to be friends with as many comedians and ultimately ending up marrying one. So I'm a bit of a fan. But yeah, they did a, I suppose for American listeners, it's like kind of like Mystery Science Theater 3000 or Riff Tracks, except you... So they're talking over the top, like they're replacing the lines of an old cop
dubbing,
show.
They're dubbing over an old cop show and the guy is a big boy and so the cop show is...
obesely overweight. Yeah. Like he's huge. It was a show called Bluey that was like a cop show that lasted a couple of years in the 70s.
Yeah.
And so it's just ripe for parody.
Yeah, and the other day we actually watched an episode of an old episode of The Late Show the other day. I think it was Best Of, Volume 2. We just started watching. Man, I don't know if it's the nostalgia in it makes us laugh, but I can't disassociate with the fact that watching it again and remembering it makes me laugh. However, I don't think so because, like, obviously there's some really outdated sketches and stuff, and obviously the stuff that's, like, not as funny, but there's so many sketches that are just on fucking point.
Mm.
Like the Eddie Charleston sketch where Mick Malloy plays pool against Eddie Charleston, who's like a world famous...
He plays snooker. So there's like world, it's essentially the world championships of snooker.
Yeah.
Eddie Charleston, who's a famous Australian snooker champion, is playing someone from Britain. And Mick Malloy playing a bogan version of himself, or basically himself. Walks into this championship and basically... The premise of the sketch is what would happen if a bogan from the local pub just walked into the world snooker championships,
and what would happen? Yeah, great. it's so great. Like, we're playing for Potsdam, Eddie?
Playing for Potsdam, Eddie. Hey, you know what you should do? Because he's like, chalk, I can't find any chalk. And then, like, the referee for the match comes over and gives Mick chalk to, like, chalk his cue.
Mm.
Just dumb shit, like... You know what we should do? You should attach this a little bit of string at the end of the table. Stops idiots from nicking it. Now, go away. And then he puts the little bit of that I love is that he grabs the chalk and puts it in his top pocket. It's not. It's a pretty subtle
joke. Where
he's
Winnie Blueser.
Yeah, where he's Winnie Blueser. Yeah,
and so, it's not because he's not playing the character like, I'm a bogan. It's just Mick Malloy being himself. Yeah,
the
go
vast
away.
Majority. Like, we went and met up with some friends last night at the Moreland Hotel, which is a...
Mate, if you haven't been,
architectural
do yourself a
favor. Icon in Brunswick. It's obviously run by a Greek family, and so the interior of the dining room is. I mean, I just don't know how to describe it. There's Michelangelo's David in there. There's like a
penis and all.
Yeah, there's the Colosseum. Well, maybe it's an Italian. Is it Italian?
Well,
maybe?
That's Italian, but I thought.
And the Colosseum is Italian as well.
Yeah, but all the wording around is very Greek. So, yeah. But the roof is really high and they've painted it like a sky. And there's just fake pillars everywhere. Fake white pillars everywhere.
It's Australian,
and tiled. And,
yeah, Australian, Italian / Greek architect. It's just crazy.
Like,
it's
you know
so
that Greek
funny.
Writing that's kind of like angles, really hard angles? Like, they're on the door. And it says, pedestrians, beware of cars, in that funny writing. So it's like, hey, beware, don't get run over by a car. Like, it's just, like, they can't even, like, in a serious, there's something that's, you know, like, they should be putting in a font that's more serious.
Yeah, but the Mick's character in that sketch could have been at that pub that we were at last night.
At the pokies.
It's no surprise to me that if you go back and watch The Late Show that the quality of the writing is still good because the people who are in that writing room have done, like, they made Crackerjack, The Castle, Utopia.
Mm. Frontline still to me is one of the best TV shows Australia has ever produced. It's like, you watch it now, it has aged very well. Watch it now and see, and then nothing has changed in terms of how the media represents things. Like, this is a show, and I think they started doing it. They started showing it for media studies in Year 12. But this show should be shown for everyone needs to understand how media does things.
Yeah, it's a parody of, like, shows like A Current Affair,
60 Minutes,
which, 60 Minutes, stuff like that. Like, sensationalized news magazine programs. So.
And how they manipulate things, and it's funny. Hmm. Like Prousey, one of the best characters ever created. Prousey, season 3, Frontline. What was his name? He was in the big steel.
Steve Bisley.
Yeah, Steve Bisley. And Prousey is like a cowboy. Comes in, he's just like, nah, cut it, go. Like, just this fucking cowboy. The
Steve
only
Bisley.
Thing that looks good on me. Like, he just walks into the office one time and just does that song. Just sings that song.
Steve Bisley, apparently very good mates with Mel Gibson. And they were, you know.
We went to NIDA together.
Yeah. Ripped it up together back in the day in the 80s. Mm. We're kind of getting the structure of the show back after our honeymoon and stuff. And something that we were doing before we went on holidays was that I would ask you a question about something sort of TV and film related. We haven't done that the last few episodes.
Oh, okay.
So my question is,
yes,
on the back of me sort of getting back into a podcast this week, is there someone in film and TV that you kind of have had a long relationship with and you keep going back to? I'll give you my example and then maybe that gives you a bit of time to think about it. For me, my guy that I can't give up is Kevin Smith.
Oh, yeah.
So, like, okay. I saw Clerks, loved it. Saw Mallrats, loved it even more. Chasing Amy, one of my favorite films of all time, although I'm sure it's hugely problematic now.
Oh, yeah.
Dogma, I still love. I still love that film so much. I got into podcasting because of Kevin Smith. The first podcast I ever downloaded was Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back, where basically Jay and Kevin Smith would get up and just talk shit about for an hour and a half, 2 hours. And then I'll sort of like move away from him. Obviously, his output in the last 10, 15, 20 years has not been great, but he podcasts like a motherfucker and I'll move away from him and then come back to him. And I've sort of got back into listening to him in the last really week or two. I just love listening to him. He is such an amazing orator. He tells great stories. And just listening to him then, he's like editing a friend's film at the moment. So he's moved out of directing and writing and it's like moving more into like... Like he's like, I just wanted to edit a film, so I'm editing this guy's film, you know. And obviously, he's he's king of the nerds as well, right? So like, he's always talking about comic book stuff. So that's right up my alley. But I just can't quit him. I just can't quit Kevin Smith, and it feels like every 3 to 4 years he comes back into my life in some way.
I don't know how to quit you. I feel like for me, probably Working Dog.
Yeah,
I probably always go back to them because the panel. I remember like loving the panel so much. I used to send the panel VHS tapes of stuff that I think that they would find interesting.
Yeah.
And they would play them and they would be like, oh, this was sent in by Kelly Fustuca. You know, like they always – and then I remember like Susanna Mott, who I think is there. She still works there. I don't know. I think she's like a producer and stuff. She like if they had spare tickets – on the day, she would like call me and go, hey, I've got 4 tickets for tonight. Do you want to come in and watch the panel? Like, because I was such a diehard.
Yeah.
Like I always, because I was so, I don't know, I was so young and piggybacking off the whole late show stuff. But, yeah, just I feel like maybe them. But I feel like they definitely formed my humour, my sense of humour of like the more serious in tone but stupider the joke, the funnier it is. Case in point, if you Google a late show sketch that is – oh, no, don't go – the bloody Google Nest just started flashing. No, don't do anything. If you YouTube the sketch Santo the Magnificent, this is – and I feel like I heard on the grapevines or the audio commentary that Santo was maybe trying to get this sketch up – for ages and everyone kept on telling him, no, it's dumb, because it is dumb. But this is the perfect example of more serious in tone, but the stupider the joke, the funnier it is. And when you watch this sketch live, the audience is dying. It's so funny. Basically, Santo is a magician who has bad,
he's
magic.
He's bad at magic.
He's bad, but he's so serious where he's like, I am going to juggle 12 things at the one time. Mick, hand me the can of fruit salad. And like, and then like.
Tune in next week where I'll attempt to lie on a bed of nail clippings.
And then like, they've got like a box, like a disappearing so box. And they're like, Mick, go into the disappearing box. And they put the curtain over. What? 3, 2, 1. And he's here.
Yeah. He just opens the curtain again.
Like, it's just.
He appears.
It's so. Like what? Like he blindfolds Mick and says, all right, Mick, like I'll use my power of telepathy to like tell Mick what I'm holding when Mick's blindfolded. Mick, what am I holding in my hand this time?
He's holding a watch.
He's holding a watch. Anyway.
He's holding a watch,
it's
guys.
It's just really, really fun and silly and I love it, which is not the thing we watched this week for the podcast, not fun or silly. You came in the other day, Damien came home the other day and I was watching some documentary. Actually, I probably was watching what we watched, and Damien's like, "Ah, see, you're watching murder, a show about murder again." No, Damien, mass murder times 10. We watched on Disney Plus. There's a Jonestown documentary, and it comes in three parts. And I watched it all in one sitting, and then Damien, you were just going to watch one episode, and you end up watching it all too.
Yeah, pretty much. What is the actual... Remember, all spoilers, no facts, to the point where we don't even know the name of the show that we watched.
No, I'm looking at it now.
I'm looking at it right now.
On Disney, because there is a bunch. It's definitely on Disney Plus, yeah?
Yes.
I'm sorry.
Anyway, yeah, so like... Kelly, we've spoken about it ad nauseum on the podcast, and usually when we talk about what we've been watching throughout the week, Kelly's recommendations are, I watched a documentary where a whole bunch of people died on Mount Everest, or I watched a thing about, you know, it's always true crime stuff. And so when it's kind of suggested, and I have a bit of a problem with true crime because I feel like there is... I feel like people profiteer off other people's misery. Mm. And so I kind of stay away from it. Even though when we first got together, we talked a lot about Last Podcast on the Left as a podcast we both love. And you like know those guys and are friends with them and stuff. So we haven't really done a lot of this stuff for the podcast. So this is kind of new for us. And really, in reality, you had already watched it and we had very little time before we were going to record. So I was like, all right, fine. Stooks has already watched it, so I'll just watch an episode of this and then I'll shit on it. So I will put my cards on the table that I had every expectation of coming into this show and being like, or this documentary and being like, who cares? Fuck these people. Fuck Jim Jones. Jonestown. What is the fascination with it?
It's called Cult Massacre, One Day in Jonestown.
Yeah.
Disney Plus.
We didn't talk about other stuff we've watched this week, but we could probably skip it.
I feel like there's been a few things about Jonestown and the Last Podcast on the Left series on this. I don't know if it was three or
like,
five episodes.
I feel like it was more than that.
Yeah, it was like five episodes.
Six or seven or something crazy. It was really detailed. Like it was really in-depth.
Yeah, it's excellent.
And there was also a part of me that was like, I'd listen to that podcast. I kind of know the story. I sort of, this is a very weird way of coming to a story, but there is a band called the Brian Jonestown Massacre. There's a really excellent music documentary called Dig, and it's basically a documentary about the Dandy Warhols and the Brian Jonestown Massacre and how they are friends. They're bands that sort of started at the same time. They're in the same scene. Brian Jonestown are probably a little bit more popular than the Dandy Warhols, and it just happens to be one of those lightning in a bottle moments where the Dandy Warhols sort of explode at the same time as they're making this documentary.
Mm.
And what happens between the two bands, and they sort of fall out, and Black Rebel Motorcycle Club also form out of these two bands at the same time. So if you like music at all, or even just good documentaries, you should check that out. But I kind of got into Jonestown because of that and then just sort of looked up what, because I didn't even really, I knew that there was the Jonestown Massacre but didn't know anything about it. So kind of felt like going into this documentary, I kind of felt like, I know this story. Like, what the fuck are you going to tell me that I don't already know? And I also don't want to spend, there's also a part of me that feels like with some of these documentaries, even though I'm sure the intentions are to show how horrific some of these people are, I feel like sometimes they almost get propagated into celebrity status and we shouldn't know who they are and fuck them, you know? Like, but the story, the angle in this documentary, which is basically there were a group of Americans who went to Jonestown 4 days before the massacre to try and get people out because there were family members and friends who had left the church, in inverted commas, who had petitioned a senator, a California senator, to help because they knew that weird shit was going on, that people were being held against their will and horrible stuff was happening.
And it's a thousand people.
Yeah, and there were 1,000 American citizens in this town that were essentially kind of like being held hostage. And so the documentary starts with this group of about 20, 30 people who go down to Guyana. There's reporters, there's family friends, and this senator who go down on a sort of rescue mission.
So Leo Ryan's also there as a way where he's kind of like a peacemaker as well, where he's like, look, I'm just going down there to investigate and see what's happening. And they were very sort of careful. I feel like they were really careful when they got there about, hey, I'm just checking it out, just making sure. We've heard some, you know, had some family members come to say that they're trying to get their family members back and they can't. We just want to know if those family members are being held against their will or blah, blah, blah. And the first night he was there, it was like they had a big party and it was dancing. And they show this footage of him, of Leo Ryan doing a speech where he's like, you know, I can really tell that you people just love it here. And they scream and applaud for what feels like 2 minutes. Like they won't stop applauding to the point where he's like trying to like go, okay, to talk more and he can't. He's like, all right. Like they're just like – and it's also kind of fair to say like one of the things I didn't realize as well is that the majority of people were, you know, social economic backgrounds were – they were all very poor people or like he targeted groups of people that, you know –
Well, there were a lot of African American people in the group, and
but
stuff,
also but native people to Ghana as well were there, like Spanish people, like Hispanic people. I mean, that you know, like promising them like free housing, free this, free that, a community.
Yeah, they kind of set it up in the beginning that like his whole message was like, there was like they were like a rainbow coalition, yeah. And that the people wouldn't be trodden upon because of their background or skin pigment or anything like that. So there is, when you see the footage, there's like a huge representation of people from different backgrounds. But yeah, like so the first, there's three parts to this documentary, and the first part they kind of I suppose the major get as far as, so sorry, just to backtrack a little bit. The difference between this documentary and other documentaries is the amount of footage that they have.
Yeah, heaps of footage.
Because they are interviewing people from that press corps who have obviously fully cooperated with the making of this documentary. And so there is footage that is just like amazing to see. They can basically show you the 4 days leading up to Jonestown from footage that existed from the time. There's no recreations. There's none of that bullshit at all. It's all actual footage and just talking head interviews.
And interviews, with the people that survived getting out and stuff. That was quite, like, I haven't really seen that before.
And from my point of view of thinking I knew everything and didn't really know, I didn't know anything about this story about the Americans who went down to try and rescue people. Their story is harrowing and amazing. And should be made into a film.
They tried to do TV shows.
When
and
I
stuff,
was watching this, I'm like, this should be adapted into a screenplay.
Because it actually like, is a film. Like,
and if the tone was like a thriller slash horror, like not horror in the sense of like a thriller, slasher suspense, film, but like a suspense thriller film, you could absolutely make a fantastic film out of it. Whether that would be disrespectful to the people who died, maybe it is. I don't know. But the story is compelling. And like, watching it at first, it was like, oh, here's another typical, like, for me anyway, it was like a typical sort of true crime documentary. It was like, oh, Jim Jones was like, and his son, who was part of the church as well, was kind of his vice captain, is also part of this documentary, and we'll sort of get to him later. But
they never really explained how he survived.
Well, he wasn't there.
Well, where was he?
He was in Georgetown, which is the capital of Guyana.
Why?
He was looking after their main office. He looked after the office.
Right, okay.
So all the books and money and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But like, not, this is a difficult sort of subject to make light of, but one thing that I thought was very funny, always they talk about these fucking serial killers and psychos and stuff as being charismatic. And whenever I see them, I'm like, no, they're not. And this is just another example of that, of like his son was like, you know, people never talk about my dad, about how charismatic he was. And then it like cuts to him and he sounds like a cross between Gwildor from Masters of the Universe.
It tasted good.
And Ned Flanders' dad. Get... you know what I mean?
I can't, daddy.
We've tried nothing and we're all out of ideas.
Yeah, that's exactly, you know, and then you see him talking later on. And he's like, no one wants to leave here, do they? You don't want to leave here, do you? You like, he's just, there's nothing charismatic about this guy at all. He's like 5'4", 100 kilos. Like, he's a chubby little fat man. He looks like Mark David Chapman,
who killed John Lennon. Yeah, he does.
They always look the same. They've always got those yellow aviators. They always talk in these weird little voices like this, you know? Like, I just understand people are looking for answers and people are looking for happiness and all that kind of stuff. It just amazes me how people get wrapped up in these people, because he's not charismatic. Nothing I saw at any point. Like, he immediately comes across as someone who is on some sort of spectrum, because he can't emote at all. Like, you don't see him, like, you don't, he's got the same tone the whole time. Like, whenever he's talking, even when they're like, oh, he got really angry that day when the NBC reporter was asking him about abuse in the camp. And I'm like, is he angry? Because it seems like he's talking exactly the same way as he did when they said he was super charismatic.
They reckon, because he was also a drug addict, really bad, like barbiturates and stuff. And they reckon that when they did the autopsy on fucking God, my brain is, I feel like I'm having a stroke. When they did an autopsy on Jim Jones, he his level of barbiturates in his bloodstream, for someone who hadn't, if that was the same amount as someone who hadn't built up a tolerance, they would be dead. Because that's how bad. So he was like crazy leading these people and they're following him, but he was off his rockers, like just like Hitler was. Like, Hitler was addicted to speed and all that sort of stuff. Like, it's just fucking crazy, like fucking got to invade. Oh, but this doco though, because you're right, like what's different about this one is like the footage end to end of how things were happening, and then the talking heads, because
the story is basically the Americans who go down there. It's from their point of view, and so Jim Jones sort of keeps, you know, they give you a bit of backstory on Jim Jones because you might not know about it, and it's been 50 years since it, well, 45 years since it happened.
Because everyone knows that, you know, Jonestown is responsible for, you know, when someone has drunk the Kool-Aid.
Yeah.
Because they put cyanide in the Kool-Aid, and that's how a lot of people died and that kind of stuff. And it's like 900 people died. And you'd say 900 people in a mass murder, but like 900 bodies. So when they had to go down there in the hot and like trying to identify bodies and the smell, and they've got footage of people walking through and just see all these dead bodies everywhere, like just frozen in time, like trying to identify who's who, and it just stinks because it's hot.
Yeah.
But just like the talking head accounts of, so I guess we are all spoilers, no facts, yeah?
Yeah.
So so when the senator goes there and, you know, that big applause thing, and then the next day people start kind of passing, like have like the, there's a female lawyer and they're like giving her notes saying, hey, I want to leave. So they're like, okay, so if people want to leave, they can come with us. Like, people allowed to leave, Jim. Sure, people can leave. Everyone's free to leave whenever they want, whenever they want. So all of a sudden you've got like 12 people who are like, we want to leave. And they're like, fine, no problem. And then as they, because I didn't know this, the documentary kind of, they get on a truck to go to the airplane.
The airstrip.
There's no airport. It's just an airstrip. And they're just like just one
a
engine.
Hut and a...
Yeah, propeller track, planes. Basically. But what I didn't know, which the documentary showed me, is that because I knew what happened once they got to the airstrip, but I didn't know that when – so one carload of people goes to the airstrip and then the second load comes, and that's where Leo Ryan is. And Leo Ryan, his shirt's ripped, he's got blood on him. So as he was trying to leave, someone tried to stab him, and then people like, you know, got control of the situation, and then the lawyer was like – when I saw that, because up until then, everything was fine. Like everything, you know, okay, people can leave, no problem. And she's like, when he started walking back going, oh, some guy, some crazy guy tried to kill me. Well, you know, stab him, whatever. She's like, I was like, we need to get out of here right now. I don't know what's going to happen, but we need to get out of here. And I didn't know that someone had tried to attack him before then. And then she was right, because before the plane was able to take off, another carload of people came with guns and just shot everyone.
Yeah. And there's actual footage of that.
Because one of the people shot was the cameraman. And you see, and they showed the footage of the camera, like filming, like guys getting off the back of a truck with guns and just poof, and then all of a sudden the camera go like
So they assassinate five of the 20 odd people who were there. Pretty much everybody else gets
like the senator
wounded.
Gets murdered, and that's like big. That's huge.
So they shot the senator. There was a reporter from NBC who only like 10 minutes before that, like they had. That reporter had interviewed the senator about what had happened previously, where he was like they had attempted to stab him.
Yeah, so and they kind of shrugged it off a little bit, but was like, yeah, I think it was just one off, maybe a crazy guy, but let's just get out of here quickly.
Yeah, I think these guys are used to high pressure situations. Like, all of these guys were correspondents, so they would have been in Vietnam and you know what I mean? Like, I think journalists, it's kind of like people who work in an ER will talk about stuff with like a stony face. Because they're so used to it. You know, my mum, she was a nurse, so she would tell stories about stuff that would happen at her work, and she would be so calm telling it. And I would be like, Jesus Christ. Like, and it's not through lack of compassion or emotion or whatever. They just control their emotions a little bit better, I think.
Yeah.
But that's the point in the story where I was like, holy shit. Because up until that point, I was like, yeah, I kind of had the footy on my phone at the same time. And I was like, it was interesting. I was paying attention. But once this happened where Jones had obviously sent like his hit squad out to like assassinate the senator and anyone else who got in the way, I was like, oh, fuck, this is bad. And there was like a guy who was there with these young sisters who got shot, and he like ran off into the jungle, and so he's telling his story of like
and he must have been young because
it would have been 15-16. It was like out in the jungle overnight and
with a gun wound.
And then all the other people like went off into this like she had been shot pretty badly, so they all went off into this hut. Like they basically all played dead, the gunmen leave, they all go off into a hut overnight expecting these guys to come back at any time and try and finish the job.
Yeah, or rescue and then nothing. But then sometime the next day, a massive plane from USA came.
The plane that was there to pick them up took off as well because they were in the plane when all this happened. So the two Guyanan pilots were like, fuck this, we're out here.
Yeah.
So, I mean, obviously they were in shock and just fled.
Yeah.
But they did go back to Georgetown, which is the capital of Guyana, and get people to come back and rescue them. So the next day, and like word spread to America that like the shit's going on. So there's rescue people, a medevac come down that gets them out of Jonestown, but at the same time that that's happening, the mass suicide, the Kool-Aid suicide,
which no one knew was happening. But what I also found interesting with this doco was when they were interviewing a Marine maybe or someone, where he was like, so we, you know, these are like, you know, ex-Vietnam
guys. So this is the third episode where Americans have come now flown down to like get people out, expecting to extract like the 1,000 people.
Well, they came there ready to like, all right, we need to move in. So they came there like with guns, like ready to, you know, like if it was a seizure or whatever, like ready to like overtake and free people and that kind of stuff. And then when he got there, that was really interesting to me because he was like, I'm a fighter. Like I fight in wars. I have a gun. Like they were all like, you know, special ops unit. And he goes, and then when we got there, we realized that we didn't need our guns at all. This was this wasn't a rescue mission at all, because when they got there, everyone was dead. They didn't need to move in and do anything.
You know, the thing that really stood out to me,
and he wasn't used to it. That was what I was. Because he got emotional because he was like, that's something. He's like, I'm used to like shooting people, bad guys and stuff like that. But he wasn't used to like, you know what I mean? Like there's a difference between the army and recovery. And he came there as army but ended up being recovery. He's like, that was something I just wasn't trained for. you know, and it shocked, you know, it shook him.
The most amazing thing, the thing that legitimately made me go, holy shit, is the one of the journalists who had been shot, not mortally wounded, but had like a flesh wound. He was on the plane about to go back to America and then decided to get off the plane and continue to cover the story. Did he work for like the San Diego Chronicle or something? He was a newspaper journalist. I'm sorry, I can't remember his name. If you watch the documentary, you'll know the guy I'm talking about.
Tim Ritterman, San Francisco Examiner reporter, maybe?
Yeah, that might be him. I think that is him. And so he went with the army to Jonestown and saw all of this carnage. And then you see him later on, either that day or the next day, interviewing Jim Jones's son in the office of the church, whatever their church was called. And he's really going him. And that, to be, this is my one criticism of the documentary. This was the point where Jim Jones's son was sitting there kind of defending himself. And I was like, nah, fuck you, man. I understand that you're trying to distance yourself from your father. I understand you're saying, like, I hated my father, blah, blah. Well, yeah, okay, maybe. And, like, maybe you didn't have any other option. But I wasn't going to sit around and listen to this guy justify himself, you know? It just felt like, to me, it felt like, well, I'll cooperate with this documentary as a way of exonerating myself from any guilt, you know?
Yeah.
And I was like, No. I mean, maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. But it just.
But I felt like that about. There was a talking head with a guy who. So when all the Kool-Aid stuff was happening, they gave him money and they went, here, take this money and then run and go, blah, blah, blah. And then he said goodbye and he, like, said goodbye to his wife and kid. And then as he was leaving, he saw his wife and child die because they'd taken the cyanide. And then he was, you know, like, so he was still a part of it and then ran away to, because he got told to do something. And then now he was, when he was talking and then he was talking about, you know, I come back here and so my family's all dead. And then he's, you know, gotten on with his life. He's married again, had kids, and now he's got a grandkid. And they named the grandkid Malcolm after his original son that died. And he gets emotional because he's like, you know, it's incredible that, you know, how things... I don't know, like not full circle, but blah, blah, blah. But I'm like, there was a part of me that, and this is not a bad part of the documentary, it's just interesting, but there was a part of me with that guy where I was like, you're getting upset because, like, it's emotional because I named your grandkid after your first son that died and the cult that you were a part of. Like, that's your fault. And I know it's like, oh, yeah, it's his... You know what I mean? In retrospect, when you're in a cult, you can't see. Like, that's what a cult is. You've been brainwashed and the stuff. And then now he's out of it. He's out of the brainwash. But a part of me was like, man, you should – I don't know, like, ugh, that's your fault. They died because of you. You were there. You were there for a reason. Like, you weren't – like, in your talking head, you weren't saying, I knew this place was fucked and I couldn't get out. You were like, oh, you know, I was a part of it and just, like, you know, sheep. Wake up, sheeple.
So we've probably bounced around all over the place sort of telling the story.
It's a good doco, man. It's only three episodes.
It's really good. Yeah, it was a really interesting story. The first episode, it is setting up the story and it, like, without that first episode, the next two aren't as compelling, but...
it's really good.
Yeah, it's an interesting story. Like I said at the beginning, I fully expected to come in to record today and be like, fuck this shit, this is another example, blah, blah, like typical Damien Rant. Yeah,
it's good.
But I think I think this is different to a lot of the shit that ends up on Netflix that I have a problem with, like Baby Reindeer, for example, where I'm like, who gives a fuck? This story. This just glorifies people.
Bad things,
this is just bad behavior. This is a down the line documentary that documents a really horrible thing that happened and hopefully people get some insight into like what to look for so they don't get caught in these situations themselves and gives you a moment to pause to be like, because I found myself thinking like, this guy is a nut job. He has very little charisma. And then I was like, but there's fucking hundreds of people
there, so he must have some charisma.
Yeah, there must be something going on. And then I was like, you know, not to join the old man brigade of like, oh, the internet's bad and you should watch out for the internet. But then I was like, well, there's certain people that I listen to on podcasts who you wouldn't say are riddled with charisma, but yeah. I'm still listening to their podcasts and stuff.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it can only be a hop, skip and a jump for certain people to end up in these situations. But it did give me pause.
That's why he targeted poor people, because it gave him some hope.
Well, yeah. Yeah. Mm. I mean, if you sell hope, then I suppose, you know, you're not going to go wanting for people to join you. But I think this kind of documentary is what is needed when telling these kind of stories. Because I did walk away from it thinking the tone of this story is one of caution, not one of like
glorifying anything.
No, and also like telling the story of the people who sacrifice themselves to try and get people out out of Jonestown.
Yeah, it humanizes the story.
That's the important story in all of it. Like, because all human life is important, and it's tragic. That, I mean, when you think about the kids that died in that situation, it's pretty awful.
The children, and that's the thing, because people that saying, like, drinking the Kool-Aid. And I know that it was Jim Jones' son that said this, and you'd hate it, but I did appreciate when he said, you know, when people talk about drinking the Kool-Aid, he's like, I never find that funny because there's so many deaths associated with it.
Mm.
And the kids, 400 babies. You know what I mean? Like, it's like I can't. And then the recordings. So, because he's recording himself as it's all happening, Jim Jones is recording himself, like just audio recording him, like telling people, we have to do this. This is the only way. They're going to kill us if you don't kill yourself. But the one kind of, there was a, at the end, I didn't know this. The documentary showed me this, but I didn't realize that the one piece of hope. The one thing that kind of was a really kind of bittersweet part to it was the lawyer that was Leo Ryan's lawyer that ended up getting shot, and, you know, she got shot 3 times.
Mm.
She was in hospital for 2 months because it was so bad, and she survived. She got sworn in 20 years later. She got sworn in as a senator by Nancy Pelosi.
Hmm.
For Leo Ryan's seat 20 years later.
Right.
And that was quite emotional watching that. Like, I thought that was quite beautiful because, you know, and you can tell, like, because I showed the footage of her getting sworn in and everyone's cheering and stuff because everyone knows what that means, where she kind of was like, she was a lawyer and then she's gone, no, I need to do more. I mean, I need to be a public servant now. It was quite sweet.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, and I think that's what this documentary does well, is that it highlights the stories of these people who went down there. Don't get talked a lot about, you know. I think even with Last Podcast of the Left's
the sacrifice that people
story, yeah, like their version of the story is that, you know, and what they do is lampoon assholes. So obviously they're going to spend most of their time ripping on Jim Jones.
Yeah, this is more humanized.
But this is I felt like this was an important story that hadn't really, you don't hear much about. So
it gets glorified when they make like telly movies about it and stuff. Like it was important that they did the right thing here, and I think they did.
Yeah, it was like a tribute to the people who passed away and shone a light on a really interesting story that didn't exist. And is a warning against the cult of personality.
Tale of caution.
That exists
How many grumps?
Right across the world.
I'm
probably
going
3.5. Because
I'm going 4. Because I actually,
yeah, like I wasn't blown away by it, but I think it's a really interesting story. I thought the documentary was made really well. Like, it's just a good, well-made documentary. But for me to give like a true crime type thing 3.5 stars is high praise.
Yeah, because that's not your bag.
No,
and
I
even
don't
when
like
I said
you
should watch this, we should do it for the pod, you're like, Matt. So I'm actually really glad you enjoyed it, because we actually have a TV show to like talk about, and it's nice, you know.
Yeah,
it's something I'm interested in, because I'm quite, into like at the moment the podcast I'm listening to is Unsolved Mysteries. Remember the old because I just like mystery stories.
Yeah.
Anyway, but I'll give it 4 grumps. I actually liked it. I thought it was really good. We need to wrap up because I need to go to the toilet.
Next week we'll be back to the same old shit. We'll watch The Acolyte, new Star Wars show.
Oh, fuck. Here we go.
It's meant to be really, really bad.
Oh, do we have to watch it then? It's better when we like stuff. It's better to watch stuff we like because then we're more passionate about it.
No, we'll do a movie or something next week.
All right. Well, thanks for listening, everyone. Thanks for subscribing. Give us 5 stars. Tell your friends. Spread the word. Yeah. We're a fun podcast.
Get it out there. We're really bad at promoting ourselves, so if you guys could do it for us.
We don't believe we deserve it.
Yeah, we had a conversation the other day where both of us were like, I was like, you know, every time I have a social interaction with another human being, I walk away from it going, they hate me. And Kelly was like, same.
I know. I'm like that's why did they invite me? They just invited me because they feel sorry for me. Everyone always just feels sorry for me. That's why I'm only invited.
Yeah,
to
we get the charity vote to every invitation that we get. Anyway. It's like, well, we might as well invite these two fucking morons.
All right. So thanks for listening.
So anyway, we have terrible self-esteem and mental health. And if you could promote our podcast, it'd make us feel better.
Okay. I love you.
Yeah, love you too.